Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Hello, and welcome to New Horror Express, your fortnightly podcast chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on this episode, I'm chatting to director, writer, producer, and founder of Snowfort Pictures, Travis Stevens, about his directorial debut feature, Girl on the Third Floor, which premiered to much acclaim at this year's South by Southwest. Over the course of the interview, we talk about the initial idea of the movie, the casting of the picture, the themes of the film, and what it was like to shoot in a supposedly haunted house. Travis also tells us how different it was directing instead of his usual producer role, and how it was important to him to direct this picture on his own terms. Finally, in this episode, you can hear me geeking out a little bit. As a punk fan, I was excited the film was scored by Steve Albini, and as a wrestling fan, I was excited that the star of the film is Phil Brooks, a.k.a. CM Punk. So Travis and I chat a little bit about that. And he even offers to do a weekly Phil Brooks podcast with me, an offer I might still take him up on. Anyway, quickly, before we get on to the interview, the best way you can support New Horror Express is to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. But now, on to the interview with Travis. Hello, Travis. Welcome to New Horror Express.
Hello, Scott. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you out there in LA?
Well, it is sunny, dusty, and you can smell the hunger in the air. So I guess it's like any other day.
Excellent. That's great. I was chatting to somebody else from LA last week, and it seemed very, very similar to that. Out here in Edinburgh, in Scotland, it's grey and very Scottish. So it's another typical Edinburgh day as well.
With a bit more magic.
Do you mean LA with a bit more magic? Or?
No, hey, Edinburgh. I love that city. I had the pleasure of being there for Dead by Dawn 1 year. And crossed a bunch of firsts off my list. Ate fish and chips out of newspaper. Saw football stadiums, like sort of, you know, local town football stadiums, which I'd never seen before. And saw somebody glass somebody outside a pub. So it felt like I got my money's worth on that.
Yeah, no, that's a full Scottish experience right there. Yeah, we saw the football, ate fish and chips, and saw somebody glassed. That's
exactly.
Oh, yeah, cool. Well, which film were you over for Dead by Dawn?
It was, I worked for a foreign sales company, and one of the first acquisitions I did was a mountain bike horror film from Germany called Blood Trails. Mm-hmm. And so I got to travel over there. It was the first international film festival I had gone to. And it was awesome. And I think I made it through most of the night in all of the films. But yeah, it was a good time.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. Dead by Dawn, I just actually happened just the other weekend there. I go there quite often, and recently did an episode of the podcast there for it. Anyway, yeah, I mean, this is an interesting start to the podcast. I was going to start with talking about your new movie and directorial debut, Girl on the Third Floor, which we'll talk a little bit about now. So for listeners who might not have heard. Tell us a little bit about the film, what the film is about.
Girl on the Third Floor is the story of Don Koch, who has convinced his wife to buy a house, a Victorian mansion, outside the city of Chicago. And he's convinced her that he can fix it up himself and that they can sort of have a fresh start in this house. And over the course of the movie, we discover that maybe Don's done some things in his past that have threatened the marriage. And this particular house has the ability to sniff out the worst qualities in people. And the movie itself follows Don as he tries to confront those qualities.
And what, because you wrote the film as well, what kind of first inspired what was the first seed of the film?
So the financing company is based in Chicago, and they had actually come across this house on the market as a potential real estate investment, and then heard these rumors that the place was haunted. And they had the idea, hey, rather than just treat this as a real estate investment, maybe we should make a haunted house movie inside a haunted house. And, you know, which is a pretty brilliant idea. It'd be like filming the Amityville Horror inside the actual house itself. Mm-hmm. So that house and its backstory had sort of been defined in local gossip and sort of local legend. It was reportedly a bordello back at the turn of the century, and it sits across the street from a church, a beautiful German church. And so for me, that the starting point was, well, here's a location, and here's you know, some facts about it. And that was my starting point as a writer, was how do you both honor the trauma that supposedly took place in the house and come up with a fresh story in the haunted house subgenre that builds off of the facts. And I don't mean builds off the facts in such a way that it becomes just about recreating what the local legends are. Mm-hmm. What I mean by building off the facts is you use that as your starting point and try to come up with a story that has a theme that resonates with the history of the house and also still works on its own terms.
So how long did it take for that kind of story, that new story, the building upon the folk tales of that house, how long did that kind of take shape? What's the process there?
A few years, because I had been approached as a producer, and we spent some time meeting with writers and directors and sort of taking pitches on it. And nothing really, there was good qualities, but a lot of it felt a bit derivative. And so I had started coming up with this idea in my head that really started with, how do you do a haunted house film that we haven't seen before? And you know, a few years ago, the basic idea of what if you did a haunted house film where at first it wasn't clear it was a haunted house film and you thought you were watching Basic Instinct or Jagged Edge or Body of Evidence. You thought you were watching almost like a 90s erotic thriller with a husband who, you know, makes a mistake and then somebody starts fucking with him. So that was my starting point. And when it came time, after spending a couple of years taking other pitches, more traditional pitches, the financiers didn't have any story that they really liked. And so I said, hey, let me just write this thing. I'll just show it to you. And if you don't like it, hey, no harm, no foul. I'll write it, at night after work and on the weekends. And if you do like it, then cool, we'll make it. And so the writing itself took about 2 weeks for the first draft. But I'd been thinking about the story and talking with people about the story for some time before it.
And as you were writing it, and when you pitched it and that you completed it, did you always picture yourself as the director of the movie?
When I started pitching it, no. I think it's, you know, I'm so used to producing that, and the type of producing that, you know, I'm a really sort of creative producer, so a lot of story sort of development, I'm used to being very involved in that. So coming up with concepts and, hey, here's a general thing, why don't you run with it, professional writer, is something I'm used to. So at the beginning of the process, I was just doing what I normally do, which is try to help develop an idea that works. After spending a couple years on this and sort of not getting frustrated, but just sort of understanding, like, well, none of these ideas are any better than mine. And then having, you know, worked on enough films where I started to feel a bit more confident in what it is required to make a good film or making a film a good experience, that all that sort of lined up when I was just like, hey, well, maybe this one makes sense to try myself, because I can't do any worse than this person did on that film or this person did on that film, which is not my films, but just in general. So it wasn't very confident. I'll say that. It's just, yeah, well, you know, I can't screw it up any worse than anybody else. So I'll just give it a go.
Yeah, because, I mean, I know you're a very experienced producer. I'm sure we'll talk more about that. But obviously, this is your first movie as a director. Most of the first-time filmmakers, well, feature filmmakers I've talked to on the podcast have, like, a bunch of shorts behind them. But, yeah, you seem to have dived straight into the deep end. So, how was that process? Was it, you know, once you actually finally got on set, was it scary? I know you've been on a lot of film sets. You're a very hands-on producer, you said. But what was the kind of process there? And was there any kind of things you didn't expect that happened that you weren't looking out for?
Yeah, I mean, on the positive side, all the sort of experience as a producer, I was really prepared for the shoot. I'd really done a lot of time prepping the film. And in writing a film that could be achieved on the shooting schedule and budget we had. So in some ways, it was just sort of like I'd rehearsed it so much in my head that when it came time to actually do the performance, it went fairly well, or according to plan, which was good. But then on the other side, I think as a producer, you're so used to thinking almost outside the movie, meaning, oh, this scene needs this type of feeling, or this scene needs, you know, we need a car chase, or we need a sex scene. You know, you're thinking outside in, that when you're the person responsible for bringing those outside qualities to life, you're not quite sure if you're doing it in the best possible way, which I think it's somebody who's come up doing a lot of short films or theater or writing a lot. It's sort of an inside out approach. You know, and so there were, even now I look at the film and I go, okay, this is the best version I could do. But is there a better version? And I think that's something that only with more experience as a director will I feel more confident about. Hopefully that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It seems like you made quite a few bold choices in the film, both with the story and with the casting, different features of the film. First, let's talk about, I read quite a few reviews, and it does seem like it's a very different take on the haunted house story, that it's quite slow burn. It doesn't go for the kind of Conjuring style jump scares every 2.5 minutes. You know, and that seems to be a very conscious decision on your part. Is that right?
Yeah. And I think there were a bunch of factors that fed into that decision on how to approach this story. One, as an artist, I don't ever want to just emulate something that's already been done. I'm always looking for our films to sort of push things a little forward, whether it's in theme or cinematic quality, like what it's trying to accomplish. Like, I never want to just do a low budget version of The Conjuring, because we're not going to be able to afford to do it as well as The Conjuring. And why attempt it with, you know, a tenth of the money? So that was one factor. And then the other factor is, I felt for this story, for a haunted house that sits across the street from a church, like, this is a little more unique than a lot of haunted house movies. And although we use some traditional tropes in this story, it seemed to make sense to really dive deeper into what that dynamic is, like a house of ill repute across the street from a house of God, and sort of what that push and pull on a person could be. And so that was another reason why I think the movie does some stuff that people might not expect.
I've certainly heard that it takes some unexpected twists and turns, and while it's a slow burn for about 2/3, then it gets a bit wild and weird in the third act. I really look forward to seeing it when it comes out in the UK, whenever that may be.
I believe you'll have an opportunity to. No, I know you'll have an opportunity to. What am I saying? I just can't say anything more than that. But to the UK, horror fiends, there will be plenty of opportunity to watch the wet, weird shit that we came up with for this movie.
Yeah, like, I was surprised, like, when it was, you know, it's a haunted house movie, and I was surprised when some people were referencing things like Clive Barker and stuff. I was like, well, that's an interesting turn.
Yeah, I mean, that's, and again, a couple of factors going into that decision. One, there's a couple of films that I'm like, this is what a horror film is, you know, from back in the day. And Hellraiser is definitely one of those films that I'm like, this is what a horror film is and should be. But, you know, also with Clive, you know, his story is sort of exploring human desire and discipline and a sort of fantasy world intruding into our world based on, our actions. It seemed to make sense to bring some of those qualities into this story.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you. Hellraiser is an incredible film. And I think because of the sequel, sometimes people forget what it's about. It's not about, like, Pinhead or anything like that, really. It's about this kind of twisted love story.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's and to me, another quality that I really like about it is it feels like a film for adults, you know, both in what it's about and what the imagery that's in there. It's just not, it feels a little dangerous and a little mature.
I know what you mean by that. It's definitely not throwaway or childish. There's real meat on the bones there. Going back to Girl on the Third Floor, also, you made some interesting casting choices. The male lead, the character of Don Cock, is played by Phil Brooks, who is better known to wrestling fans as CM Punk. Did you know about Phil's wrestling past? And it's obviously his first film. What attracted to to him as an actor? How did he come on the project?
Yeah, so I had known Phil was a professional wrestler because I'm a huge fan of MMA. So while I had not watched his wrestling career because I stopped watching wrestling in the early 90s, I was aware of him and had watched him sort of train for his UFC fights and really watched a lot of interviews with him because, to me, I come from the sort of punk rock and hardcore music background, so I was sort of fascinated by his straight edge and his sort of lifestyle, straight edge lifestyle and sort of punk rock personality in that sports sphere. I was like, that's really interesting. And it's really interesting that something that when I grew up was such a niche sort of credo, it's really interesting that that's got this huge platform now. So I just thought he was a really fascinating guy. And in watching his interviews about training for MMA, I was just really struck by his really down-to-earth quality and the fact that, you know, financially he certainly didn't need to be doing any of this. And yet he was getting in there with people far more experienced and far more dangerous than him because he wanted to do it. And I thought that was great. So when we were casting this film, we had wanted to try to cast as locally in Chicago as possible because the story is set outside Chicago and we wanted it to feel authentic, like a real sort of a movie that came out of the place rather than something we artificially constructed. So the list of Chicago working actors, you know, was there, and we were looking at it, and Phil's name came up because my producing partner Greg Newman had a conversation with the filmmaker Bobcat Goldthwait a few years before, and Bobcat had a sort of action movie he was thinking about doing, and he had mentioned to Greg that, hey, I really like this guy, Phil Brooks. I directed him on a couple episodes of Marc Maron on his show, and I just think he's great. And so that had sort of stuck in Greg's mind over the years. And so Greg had suggested, hey, what about Phil? And I was like, oh, that's really interesting. And beyond sort of how does he look and what's his experience like, I think one of the things I was immediately attracted to was it would be his first film and it would be my first film. And we could go into it together and really support each other through that process, which as a first-time director was really exciting because I wanted it to be an adventure and I didn't want anyone to worry about whether or not we were going to make it to the other side okay or not, safely or not. So I'd like, for my own super biased reasons, I was like, I would really like this. I like him as a person. I like that he's from Chicago. And I like that it would be both of our first films. And I hope he likes the script. And was super lucky that he dug it and got what the movie has to say about sort of being a bullshit artist. And I think together we had a lot of fun bringing it to life. And for like horror fans out there, Phil is one of us. He lives it, he breathes it, and he's like giddy as a kid that he's in a movie. It's so fucked up and weird. So yeah.
Before jumping into the movie, did you get him to do a reading or anything, or did you just like cast him and like jump straight in?
Just cast him. And I think with a lot of the casting, even as a producer, a lot of the decision making is based on vibe, not on actual auditions. You sort of have a conversation with someone, and in the course of that conversation, you get a sense of whether or not they understand the character and the tone of the film. And you also get a sense of what their natural rhythm is like, who they, you know, how they carry themselves. It's not to say auditions aren't useful, especially for day players and stuff. But a lot of times I feel like just having a coffee with somebody will tell you whether or not they're going to work for you or whether or not you guys are going to work well together. And with a lot of the other day player roles there's a huge sort of acting community in Chicago. But because this was my first film and we didn't have a lot of money for a casting director, I think it just had a lower profile. So I was spending a lot of time looking at people who didn't really have many acting credits and watching what I could find of them on YouTube or Vimeo, like on their personal pages, to just get a sense of what's this person like. And we were super fortunate to get a cast of just people from a variety of backgrounds who all just brought something special to it. And I think Travis Delgado, who plays Don Koch's best friend, Milo Stone, is just a fantastic actor. And then Karen Wittich, who plays our sort of version of the religious pastor, who's potentially there to help the main character. She was great. And our girls who play the two apparitions that take place in that haunt this house. One, Sarah Brooks, literally had just cast her because she said one line for a smaller part. And the way she said that line, I said, well, this person is awesome. And so I just offered her the bigger part. And then the girl who plays Sadie is Alyssa Dowling, and your listeners might know her from, she was in Cheap Thrills in the scene, she was in Starry Eyes in the scene, but we really had a blast working together on a movie called We Are Still Here, Ted Gagan's Haunted House movie, where she played Eloise Dagmar, one of the burnt ghosts. And with her, it was, it's a role that is sort of on the periphery of the film for a lot of the movie. And it's a really deformed character, really kind of a adventurous creature designed by our SFX guy, Dan Martin from the UK. And that meant I needed somebody who could really project a personality despite being hidden for a lot of the movie. And Alyssa is somebody who's done a lot of creature work and somebody who's in really good control of her body performance. And so she rounded out the cast. Yeah. Stoked on them all.
Yeah. And it does. I mean, in terms of what I've seen from reviews and stuff like that, it seems like it all pulled off really well, but it does seem like a kind of risk. You know, there's so many people were so early in their career, but it seems to have really paid off. It does seem like one of the few actors who were like kind of known quantities. I've seen We're Still Here and Starry Eyes, and Trieste seems to be one that's
What an asshole. Yeah, I'm sitting there talking about all these, inexperienced people that I found, and then there's Trias, who is like the tent post to the entire film.
Yeah. Did you was that like a deliberate thing that you thought, like, get somebody in who's, to fill out the cast?
Yeah, because with that character, the script sort of keeps the wife character, Liz Cote, at arm's length for a good portion of the movie. We're with Don, her husband, for the first half, and his perspective on his wife is a bit distant. So Liz is sort of shown in the movie on cell phones and stuff until she comes into the story on her own terms. And because of that, it was so important to have an actor who could just exude charisma and strength in that. Like, if you're only going to see an actor on a cell phone for the first 30 minutes of a movie, you got to make sure you're casting somebody vibrant so that they really register. And because this particular movie, I think the point of the movie is made by the wife character. When she comes into the story, we needed an actor who could stick the landing, even though we haven't seen her in any scenes other than on a phone before she comes into the story. She was probably the most experienced, had done, series, TV series, had done films. But another quality that she had was the ability to sort of improv or be a bit more naturalistic or looser with other actors, and that seemed really helpful in this particular case, because there would be a variety of experience levels. She had all of those qualities that from the outside seemed like this is what we need to have this work. Because again, not that you've seen the movie, but there's some distinct choices that normally you don't see in a haunted house movie. Normally it's the family that moves in and you get to know them all, and then the bad shit's happening, and this does some other stuff. And she's just fantastic. I think people are going to really dig her.
It seems like you also made some distinct choices in terms of the filming. I was reading an interview where Phil made some comments that basically his first couple weeks on the movie was just, in terms of acting, was just him maybe in the house, repairing the house, and he didn't get to do scenes with other actors till a few weeks into the film. And that's obviously a very deliberate choice. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, don't tell Phil, but we didn't run the camera for the first 2 weeks, so we were just getting in practice. but it did... I guess twofold. One is, on these lower budget movies, you have such a tight shooting schedule that it becomes even more important to find your rhythm early. And that's both for the performers and also for the crew. So sort of get into a flow and get into the vibe of what this movie is going to be. And I think that the whatever energy is going on when you're making the movie gets reflected in the movie itself. So if you are all in rhythm and everything's running smoothly, I think that shows up in the movie. And if things are totally chaotic and out of control, that shows up as well. So in designing the script and designing the schedule, I wanted to start with sort of the quieter openings of the movie and really give our main character and our main actor a chance to sort of live in the space and be in the space and work in the space, and the same thing for the crew. And the design to shooting this movie was, I'm a big fan of this lined script approach where you basically do a paper edit before you start shooting, where you're going through each scene and you're drawing a line for the duration of each shot you plan to use in that scene. So if it's a master or a close-up or whatever, you can actually on the page see how you're going to use that footage later. And so that also meant we were just sort of moving through those first couple of weeks in a very sort of methodical way. And yeah, I think that sort of led to working on a space station. You know, just a very quiet sort of approach to the beginning of the show. And then once we were all in rhythm and really knew the nooks and crannies of the house and how each day was going to go, then we started bringing the crazier shit into the movie.
So it must have been, those couple of weeks must have been really quite intimate and intense, and just shooting Phil, how was the working relationship? I mean, I've generally been a fan of Phil, both as a wrestler, and follow them into MMA, and also like MMA. But he has also a reputation as being an intense character, a sometimes spiky character. How was your experience?
I think Phil is ultimate penultimate professional. I think when you reach that sort of level of accomplishment in different fields, you just have an expectation for professionalism and things to be on time and things to be delivered as promised. Mm-hmm. And so if you want to talk about just overall what's it like to work with somebody, I'd say he's great. It's incredible. You say, hey, we're going to meet at 9, and you meet at 9, you're great. If you meet at 9:05, 9:10, 9:15, 9:20, then you're probably going to find somebody who's not understanding why they were there and you weren't. So that's, I just think he's just a real professional. And every single day, he was the one who was sort of bringing humor and lightheartedness and love to the set. I think part of because that's what his personality is like. And I think also he was really happy to be making a horror movie. So again, I can't say enough. I mean, I could fawn over him all over. In fact, if you want to start a new podcast series where each episode we just talk about Phil, I would be happy to do that because I love the guy.
Excellent. We can just start on his wrestling career and just work our way through. Yeah, sure. We can do that. Yeah. Well, I'll have my this. I'll keep this as my main podcast, and we can I can have a side project. I'm down for that. Yeah.
I love it. Yeah. No. It's great. I mean, my experience has been great, and I know that he worked with the Soska twins, Soska sisters, and they love him as well. Yeah. And
I was going to ask that actually, because like obviously this was his first movie, and but he's going to star in Rabid. I'm still not sure when it's going to come out. It doesn't seem to have a lot of info on it. I know it's in post, but yeah, were you anything to do with that, or was that just a complete separate field, this Oscar thing?
Yeah, just a complete coincidence. We were finalizing our dates and found out that he dipped off up there for a couple of days to do their film. Obviously, they're huge wrestling fans, so it didn't surprise me. And I was, stoked because I think it's great, and I can't wait to see what they've done with that movie and the fact that our star is in a remake of a movie that I love. Awesome. So yeah, and they've been super supportive as well. So throughout our sort of festival launch and publicity, they're incredibly kind to give shout outs and retweets and Facebook postings. So I will be sure to return that love next time.
Oh, well, it'll certainly be interesting. Like, I'm also a fan of the Soska sisters. I think The Likes of American Mary is a great movie. I will be interested to see what they've done with such an iconic film from Phil, Canadian filmmaker. Yeah. Going back to your movie, obviously, you've produced a lot of films. You know a lot of directors. Did you just purely focus on like, this is my movie, this is my vision, or did you reach out to anybody and like ask advice and anything like that, or you just straight ahead?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It felt important to try to do it in isolation, like I really wanted to prove myself, I guess. But there were also points in the journey that proved really challenging. And I did turn to colleagues that I had worked with and say, hey, this is the situation I'm in. What do you think? Got some incredible advice that helped me solve problems But there's a thing where normally on our films, we test screen them, not for huge audiences, but for like a small group of filmmakers. And we'll do multiple cuts, and just make sure we're heading in the right direction to make sure the movie is as good as it can possibly be. I think on this one, I had a sort of a truncated post schedule because it got into South by Southwest really early in the edit process. So we had to sort of speed things along. So I didn't get a chance to test it as much. So there's a bunch of filmmakers that have had such a huge impact on my life that I consider friends, that they haven't had a chance to see it yet. So I'm really excited for them to see it, although it probably would be a better movie if they had seen it a year ago. So,
well, we just don't know. I'm sure that's not the case, but you mentioned South by Southwest. Obviously, the film got its premiere there. Was that a film festival you particularly targeted? I know that a bunch of the movies you produced, like Cheap Thrills, Starry Eyes, We're Still Here, 68 Kill, all seem to get the premiere at South by Southwest. So it seems to be a favorite for Snowfort Pictures. Was it one you're particularly keen to get into?
Yeah, for a number of reasons. Like I feel like the audiences at that festival, and like their sensibilities and my sensibilities are really aligned. I think it's a smart town, a progressive town, and a town that really has seen a lot of movies. So with our movies, we're trying to do stuff that, you know, maybe makes the world a little bit better and does some interesting stuff with whatever subgenre it is, and mixes humor and some outlandish bits and seriousness too. Like all that stuff is a pretty unique blend, and so we've been really fortunate down there over the years to premiere movies and really find an audience. And so because of that, I really wanted this to, you know, my first film to play down there. And it was great. I love it. And like everybody's got their favorite festivals, and they're all wonderful. And we've been lucky to have movies play at all the big ones. But I just really like the team, and I like that festival. And spend most of my time watching documentaries in the day and fucked up horror films at midnight. So
sounds like a great way to spend a day.
Yeah, I think so.
You must have also been really pleased with the reaction. Certainly the reactions I saw at South by Southwest were really strong. People seemed to really like the movie. A lot of the reviews were very strong from most of the major horror websites. You must have been really, really pleased with that.
It's with festivals, you're like, I think as the first reviews, I think the thing you care most about is your intention coming through. Is what you were trying to do with the movie being picked up on. And so it was a huge relief that so many of the reviews sort of talk about what the movie's about and not just what happens in it. Because that's the goal with this, is to have it be a movie about human choices and not just, and then this happened and then this happened and then this happened and the cupboard flew open and blah, 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 blah. And I think that's one of the differences between a smaller haunted house movie like this and a bigger haunted house movie like The Conjuring is I think you can get a lot of entertainment value at a bigger budget, more surface sort of things. And I don't mean that as a slight against the Conjuring films. And I think they're incredibly well made. But I think on a smaller movie, you can't compete with that, so your movie better have something to say. And it was really nice to read so many reviews where, whether you know, I'd met the person or not, their individual experience watching the movie brought up some emotional connection to the material. Yeah, so it was great. It was awesome. And not everybody will like every movie, but it sure is nice when you know, the weekend of its premiere for most people that seem to love it. So.
Yeah. So I get what you're saying about that difference between some smaller scale horror movies, you know, needing something to say, and you know, being freighted slightly toward more towards character and themes. And yeah, like you say, the Conjuring movies are very well made, but obviously the thing they're freighted towards is like the set pieces and the scares. And I mean, I suppose it's the kind of obvious thing to talk about in those movies. But yeah, it does seem to be, from what I've read about the movie, it focuses, people have focused in on the themes of the movie and the themes of masculinity, certain types of masculinity, and how that plays out. And
yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's, and again, it all came from the actual backstory of this real location. So that was the starting point, is if you have a house that was a poor house, and the sex workers who worked there were you know, murdered. Mm. Well, yeah, that's your seed has the DNA for some toxic masculinity in it. And it's your job to sort of help nurture that and, you know, maybe rectify some of the trauma that actually took place there by telling a story that acknowledges it and tries to do something about it.
Yeah, for sure. I saw that the movie also, I was played a couple of other festivals, Boston and Chattanooga. Is there any more plans for more dates coming up?
It will be playing around the world at your favorite genre film festival. And I believe there's a fall release, at least in the U.S., scheduled. But typically, that means worldwide soon thereafter. So there will be plenty of opportunities to see it. Regardless of the country you live in, if they have a good genre film festival. And I would encourage you to go whether or not this film is in there.
Well, yeah, I always try and like to support any genre film festivals near myself, you know. But yes, any listeners listening, wherever you are, support your nearest genre film festival, because they're awesome, and you know, we don't want them to die off in the face of streaming and the like.
Yeah, no, we do not. Yeah, so that's pretty much it. So it's on the festival run. We'll start doing press and stuff in the fall, and I'm just sort of quietly scribbling away in a notebook on what comes next.
One of the other things I was wanting to talk about the movie, you mentioned earlier on in the interview, way while back, that you're a big punk guy, you know, like punk music. I love punk music. I was very interested to see that one of the composers on the film is Steve Albini.
Yeah.
How did he come on board?
Well, two ways. As I was writing it, there was a line from a Big Black song, Bad Penny, that just kept running through my head. You should have known what a liar I am. Should have known me by now. And I think that's kind of really related to our main character in this film, to the point where I was like, well, for shits and giggles, why don't I throw that song in the movie itself? So I which I never do, but I wrote the song into the movie. And then after a while, I was like, well, Steve's a Chicago guy. Why don't I just, reach out and see if he'd be interested in doing music, if he'd ever consider it. And again, like Phil, just a down-to-earth, hardworking, blue-collar artist. And he responded and said, yeah, I'd be interested in that. And, here's my availability. And do you think that could work? And what are your expectations? And blah, blah, blah. And that's great. I could answer all those questions. And so he was fantastic to work with. I was imagining a score a little bit different than when the pieces started showing up. He went in a sort of a almost like the score to the proposition a little bit, like a lot of strings. He brought in a talented violinist, Allison Chesney, and a guitarist, Tim Mida, and they sort of wrote these pieces that had a lot more expansiveness than I thought. I guess in my mind, I was like, is he just going to like bang on an electric motor for 2 hours? And is that going to be the score? And what I got back was filled with a lot of beautiful melody and texture and more human, like a more human touch than I would have imagined. So they really did great. That record will be out. The soundtrack will be out on Touch and Go Records around the time of the movie's release.
Yeah. So when you were first getting the pieces, were you just kind of expecting like an hour and a half of guitar distortion?
Yeah. And I would have been fine with it. it would have been, because it's like you, like this being my first movie, I just wanted to work with true artists that would bring their own thing to it. Like I wanted to have a conversation. I thought the script did a good job laying out what the movie was attempting to do. And I wanted to have a good preliminary conversation with each of the people we hired, whether it was the DP or wardrobe or production designers or score. And then I wanted them to run with it. And so we did, and it's great.
Oh. Yeah.
Sorry, get a text.
Yeah, just getting some messages there. Yeah.
It's Steve Albini saying, "Don't you talk shit."
All right. I don't know. I was just very amused by that. I mean, like, I always think like, there's been times where random things have happened that I always think like, oh, I did that out, and I never do. I'll probably keep this bit in, this is a good story, like you can pretend that, Steve Albini is just shouting at me.
Yeah, man. Go for it.
Yeah, so I also wanted to talk a little bit about your production, how you got into being a producer, how you came to found Snowfort Pictures, which has produced a whole bunch of really great stuff, including Starry Eyes, and We're Still Here. And so, yeah, how did that come into being? How did you found that?
I had moved to Los Angeles to make films, and I didn't know if that was as a writer or director or producer or what. I didn't know. Like in college, I just made them with friends, and we would just change roles on each short film or whatever. And then in LA, realized, oh, it doesn't work like that. You actually have to, work your way up, and you need to meet the right people, and you need to find access to money and blah, blah, blah. So that took a long time, and that led to working in an aspect of the business, sales and distribution, which is you're buying movies or making movies and bringing them to different film markets and selling them to distributors around the world. And that really is an education on its own about what buyers are looking for, what audiences are looking for around the world, and what works and what doesn't work, and really how to communicate what a movie is about. And I think when I would be in a room talking to a buyer from Taiwan or a buyer from Portugal or a buyer from Italy, being able to say, this is a movie about lust, or this is a movie about the fear of your child dying. That's something that can translate internationally. So it really sort of taught me that these movies need to have at its core something that anybody can relate to. I was fortunate enough to work under Pierre David, who was a really experienced producer and had actually produced Cronenberg's earlier films, like The Brood and Videodrome, Scanners. And so while working for him, I just said, like, hey, man, you're making these Lifetime channel, you know, TV movies now, but, you know, we should really get back to some of your roots here and get some crazy wild horror stuff going. And he was open to it. And so I started sort of looking for movies to pick up. And one of the first ones was from British filmmaker Simon Rumley called The Living and the Dead. And through that film and its sort of festival life and selling that movie around the world, that really established a lot of the relationships that to this day allow me to sort of make movies. And yeah, it's sort of given me a career. So we picked up a lot of films. We did The Zombie Diaries out of the UK. We did a movie called The Vanguard out of the UK. And then at the end of that, I said, well, I think I've learned enough here to give it a go on my own. And so some friends and I put a bit of money together into a movie called A Horrible Way to Die, which was from director Adam Wingard and writer Simon Barrett. And it came out as intended. And what was really funny is we financed it ourselves, and that was out of frustration because we were trying to make the movie for $125,000, and everybody that we met with, every company, including several that I've worked with since, were like, we don't know. It just seems too risky. So we made it for less on our own, and it premiered at Toronto International, and Anchor Bay distributed it around the world, and it was really good. And now Adam's directing Kong versus Godzilla for however hundreds of millions of dollars that costs. So, that was the beginning of it. And each sort of year, just trying to find stories that have some sort of resonance, and find filmmakers that are doing exciting things. And over the past couple of years, really trying to support, a wider array of voices, maybe people that haven't gotten a chance to make as many movies. So I've been fortunate to work with a lot of really incredible up-and-coming women filmmakers. And so, yeah, I'll continue on that that journey until the lights go out.
You mentioned when you were your process of getting A Horrible Way to Die mentioned the word risky. And it does seem like you certainly take a lot of risks, just in terms of, you know, a lot of the projects you make aren't, you know, mainstream projects. They don't, they might not have the kind of money written all over them of being box office successes. You seem to very much pick projects that you care about or that you want to take a bet on. Like, looking through your production credits, there doesn't seem to be a lot that was just like, this was just fired off for like cheap box office.
Yeah, I mean, making movies is really hard. And as a producer, you're working on them for a lot longer than anybody else. So if I don't care about the movie, the money's not good enough to do it. Like, you have to care about something if you're working on it for 5-6 years, you know, and often not being paid for the majority of that time. I mean, there's movies in the beginning of my career that I still, you know, spend a couple of days a year on that is unpaid. So, can you imagine doing that if you didn't love the movie and love what the movie had to say? Like, no. And I think that comes from, you know, just sort of the punk mentality. Have something to say, say it with passion and stand behind it. So yeah, those tend to be the stories that it's like, if I'm going to put some energy into something, this is what I'm looking for. These are the qualities that I'm looking for.
And I mean, do you have been right at the ground floor of a lot of really cool careers? Like you're saying, Adam Wingard's gone on really big things. You know, the directors of Starry Eyes, Dennis Widmer and Kevin Colger, they've just, you know, come out with Pet Sematary like last month. So you obviously have an eye for talent.
Yeah, it's been super fortunate and really organic. You know, we tend to just sort of meet at dinner parties or film festivals or on Twitter and, you know, get along great and say, hey, let's try to make a movie together. And it's been awesome. Like Evan Katz, who did Cheap Thrills, went on to do a season of the sci-fi horror show Channel Zero. He's now directing episodes of Swamp Thing. Sarah Dina Smith, we did a movie, Buster's Mal Heart, and she just did the Amazon's Hannah TV series. So yeah, it's awesome, and it's been such a good group to learn from on my end. So I feel really fortunate.
The other thing you mentioned that I wanted to pick up on as well was that you've worked with a bunch of female filmmakers like Sarah Dean Smith, and you produced the female horror anthology, Double X. Was that a kind of conscious decision to make it, to have more of a gender balance? Because I know, talking to a couple of female filmmakers, you know, it's often very difficult, and there's a lot of horror producers that don't work with a lot of female filmmakers at all.
Yeah, I forget what article it was, but a few years ago, whether Hollywood Reporter or the LA Times or somebody had posted this article about the disparity in sort of female led films versus male, and it just was like, well, holy shit. It wasn't something that I was aware of on a grand scale, and I don't even know if I had thought about it in the smaller scale of my own choices. But what became really apparent to me is the only way it's going to change is if every single day you are determined to do something about it. And that the first thing or the first step was really seeking out as many female-led projects as I could. And I think there's still more work to be done. And it's something that is, I think it's getting less challenging as more attention is being drawn to it and more people are given the opportunity and more of those talented people are succeeding. It's getting a bit easier, but there's still so much more to be done. And that's exciting to me. And again, it's gives me something to care about the project. That's a quality that maybe is as important as the story itself.
And it does seem like more doors are opening. I recently talked to a female filmmaker, Chelsea Stardust, and there is a wealth of horror female directors that seem to be coming to the fore. People like the Julia Ducker now and Jennifer Kent, Coralie Farragut, Jen Wexler, a whole, you know, the Soskas themselves we talked about earlier, a whole host of talent out there.
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. You know, and all of the films are wonderfully diverse, you know, which is the most exciting thing. It's there isn't one kind of female horror film.
No, absolutely not. And I suppose nor should people expect there to be, even though female filmmakers are quite often kind of tagged in that way. Of I remember somebody, I think it was maybe Anna Biller or something, tweeting out about, you know, like, stop making us a subgenre, you know, it's not like your favorite film directed by a female, and just like, what's your, you know, favorite film, or, you know, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's true, you know, and it's this weird thing of, in general, I don't know if it's human nature, but certainly in film, things tend to get super categorized and subcategorized and put into a little box so people can wrap their head around what the thing is and put it on the right section of the video store shelf. But it's also art, you know, and it would also be nice to be viewed on the terms of your own work and not in a subcategory of a general thing.
Absolutely. Well, to kind of round out, tell us a little bit about what's next in terms of the slate for Snowfort Pictures, and what's next for you? Have you got an idea for a second film? A second film to direct, I mean by that.
I ground my brain to dust. I've come up with a list of potential ideas, and we'll see if anybody with money thinks those are ideas worth making. So I'm at the beginning of that process now as a writer, director, producer. And as a producer on my own, I've been very fortunate to get a couple of projects in from filmmakers with sort of a genre adjacent credentials, coming from the music world. And so as a producer, I'm sort of beginning the process now of developing those and trying to put those together. So nothing definitive, but it is really exciting to wake up every day and go into the coal mine and start digging.
Excellent. Well, that seems like a fine way to finish our interview. It's been great having you on the show, Travis, and I really look forward to seeing The Girl on the Third Floor, and whenever that second project lists off, or if you just want to come on and do the Phil Brooks podcast that we talked about earlier, I'd love to chat to you again.
Yes, please. And I want to hear your thoughts after you've had a chance to see the film. So we shall stay in touch. Thank you for taking the time, and I know it's late over there, and I really appreciate such great questions. So take care.
You too. And we really appreciate Travis for being such a great guest. Plus, we look forward to finally getting to see Girl on the Third Floor. As always, we'd also like to thank you for tuning in, listener. If you would like to support the show even further, it would be great if you could rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. As well as that, you can check us out on Radio Public, which is an app totally free for you, but pays us to bring you an even better show than we have right now. Anyway, that's all for this time. Join us again in a fortnight. But until then, see ya!